Lucas on Life.
Very good evening to you. Welcome to Lucas on Life. I'm Jeff Lucas, and last week I got mugged. It was quite unexpected, both shocking and brutal. And just because the mugging was mental rather than physical, it didn't make it any less devastating. I was mugged by a moment of overwhelming doubt about my faith. Perhaps that's happened to you. Sometimes a season of doubt doesn't come as a result of a crisis or a time of intellectual wrestling or during a conversation with an atheist who skillfully undercuts your reasons for faith. It just seems to come out of nowhere. It happened when I heard of the death of a distant friend. He'd battled cancer with great courage, and when he finally received the diagnosis that his condition was terminal, he calmly prepared himself and talked about how much he was looking forward to being with Jesus. And I didn't doubt his sincerity, but when I heard that he was gone, in a moment I suddenly felt a fear that his and our whole faith construct was implausible and empty. Was he really still existing or just dead? Believing in a life hereafter in that moment seemed a little absurd. Now, some listeners might think, Jeff, aren't you letting the side down with this talk about doubt? But Christian leaders are called to be examples, not be those who project an image that gives the impression of endless certainty. That's not true, and it's not authentic, and it may well alienate those who struggle with uncertainty themselves. So let's be honest and talk a little tonight about doubt and about faith as well. When I first became a Christian, I thought that ministers never had to wrestle with doubt. They all seemed so very shiny, so holy, and so very certain. I didn't realize that their vocational choice didn't guarantee them a doubt-free existence, which can make life difficult. It's hard to fulfill one's ministerial duties while wondering if what we boldly proclaim as truth is actually true at all. Imagine it. Sorry, PCC, but I'm going through an atheistic phase. Any chance of a couple of weeks off? Doubt is a mosquito that I can never quite kill, and if past performance is anything to go by, I will never successfully swat it this side of the New Jerusalem. Most of the time, doubt rumbles rather than roars, the vaguest trembling of the ground that I stand on, distant, irritating, troubling even, but not turbulent enough to create an earthquake that Richter would be interested in. I don't lose my faith, I just mislay it occasionally. But every now and again, I have a full-on faith attack, which is more like a tsunami than an earthquake. Faith attacks strike without warning, and they're triggered by random happenings. Sometimes it's the superstitious statements that some Christians come out with that can make Christianity suddenly feel quite implausible. And for a moment, the whole faith construct seems as rickety as a coffee table made by a fifth former in the woodwork class. Or some say, you can't outgive God. Really? Then why don't we just give every penny we possessed and become utterly destitute, at least temporarily, if that's really true? Others say, God is in control of everything that happens and that everything that happens is his will. Well, as far as I can see it, he's not. At least not in the sense that everything that happens, it happens because he wants it to. If that's not the case, then why do we pray, your kingdom come, your will be done, if in a bizarre case sarah sarah kind of way, everything that happens is because God wills it? Things have gone wrong, so you must be doing something right, is another cliche that's sometimes trotted out by those who have an excessive view of spiritual warfare that may mean that Satan is, in fact, camping in my bathroom, a roaring lion crouched in the facilities. Or then the person says, I'm healed, in that exciting healing service or meeting, that it's really obvious that they're not, but they say that they are because they think they're letting the side down if they don't. Or, as I've mentioned, it can be a brush with death, which I had just recently with the passing of that friend. Again, when I heard of his death, the Easter message seemed rather empty. I didn't feel comforted, but instead felt that I was just desperately trying to be hopeful. But for that moment, or that hour or so, it just wasn't working. The possibility of there being another place somewhere else in the universe that he had traveled to, it all seemed about as likely as the Easter Bunny being a real-life carrot eater, or Santa breaking speed records with his sleigh. Just wishful thinking. My faith was not rammed by a weighty locomotive filled with brilliant new atheist arguments, but shattered rather by the hint of perhaps a satanic snigger. Surely, doubting that God exists or fearing that he's abandoned us if he does is a fundamental part of the human condition. If I'd choreographed the Calvary event, Jesus on the cross, I wouldn't have had him crying, my God, why have you forsaken me, as one of his final statements, even though prophecy was being fulfilled. That didn't sound too good, did it, seeing as Jesus had announced that he and his Father were one? I don't mean to be irreverent, but it's very bad as a parting shot. I wonder what those who heard him say it made of it without a team of forensic preachers and commentators standing by to explain it all in 3 points of alliterated sermonic clarity. Perhaps Jesus was fully identifying with us in our lostness, bewilderment, and the feeling that heaven is ignoring us at times. On the cross, not only was he challenging the power of death, but identifying with us in the experience of hopeless, desolate life. 3 days later, he rose to let us know once and for all that we are not abandoned or left destitute, and that death itself is rendered incapable of separating us from his love. And here's another thought about that parting shot from Jesus when he said, "You've forsaken me." You see, before ascending to heaven, he promised, "I'll never leave you." My occasional faith attacks, "Where are you, God?" crises, they don't mean that I'm a rubbish Christian, just another human trying to get in step with what is true. One day we'll see Jesus face to face and doubt will be banished. In the meantime, we don't enjoy that clear view, that 2020 vision of him. So if we occasionally doubt, it's just an indicator that we're not actually dead yet. Doubt is just part of the normal Christian journey, an unwelcome companion, but one that we don't need to fear. As we're talking tonight about doubt, let's face it, it's like an embarrassing itch for Christians. Christians talk about it in hushed tones. They worry that it might be contagious, and they're nervous that their reputation will be damaged irreparably if anyone knows that they've got a case of doubt. And it's very boring when, as I've shared, an outbreak hits you. For me, doubt also comes when I'm in an atmosphere of great certainty, like one of those boisterous celebration meetings where, if you're careful, you can end up with a nasal rebore from a low-flying flag. You know the feeling, the chap next to you is headbutting a tambourine with a monotonous rhythm that is causing you to have fantasies about murdering him. Or the lady sitting in front of you is so ecstatic about being a Christian that she's had her hands raised high in the air in praise throughout the whole service, including during 20 minutes of numbing notices. The cheery red coat type leader on the platform is gushing breathy platitudes into the microphone. "Don't you feel the Lord in this place? He is here." And that woman in front of you stretches out and positively touches the ceiling with her worshipping fingernails. The bloke next to you is gnawing his tambourine now with a rabid enthusiasm. And you sigh, crushed for the moment by the burden of believing. Is all this God stuff true? Is anyone out there beyond the canvas of this tent or the plaster of this ceiling? It can happen to any of us. The other time when I get mugged by doubt is when I'm flying. I'm heading somewhere to dispense large chunks of biblical teaching to some assorted gatherings of rather nice Christian people. I hurtle through the sky at 543 miles an hour, my trajectory carefully navigated by computers, enabling Nigel the pilot, I think they're all called Nigel, he announces the time of our projected touchdown to within a minute or so, even though we're still 3,000 miles from our destination. But the laws of physics and the precision genius of computer chips, they don't govern my emotional and spiritual condition. And so I am less certain about my trajectory, my time of arrival, my own consistency. And when I'm flying, wrestling with a rather bland chicken Caesar salad at 36,000 feet up, I can find myself looking around the cabin and becoming increasingly unsettled about my faith just because I'm surveying the backs of the heads of my fellow passengers. What is it that they do to cause this spiritual nervous tic to erupt in me? Well, it's simple. They unnerve me because of their normality. They sit and nurse their plastic cups and appear to have no concerns about holiness or morality, about the meaning and purpose of life, or the life-exploding eruption that breaks upon a soul when it discovers that there's a creator alive and well at the heart of the universe and one who would know me and them. But I look at them and I see no signs of fretfulness on their faces because of the niggling impotence of the church that professes Christ's name so boldly. Sometimes we witness to his life so pathetically. No, they just sit there, living another day without apparent depth or significance, mesmerized by just existing. And for just a moment, I can envy them and feel that to believe all the time is too much like hard work. And then I begin to really worry about myself in my secret, scandalous envy. My jealousy, I think, it's truly wicked. Why, I'm carrying in my carry-on a black leather-bound book that apparently announces that these people are lost. I berate myself. Do I believe that enough to do something about it? Am I truly convinced that these nice, pleasant people who apparently were made from a different gene pool from the serial killers and concentration camp guards of this earth, are they really so lost? And so doubt mugs again, and round the confused, fearful thoughts tumble. And for a while, I can feel a little bit more lost than I think they are. And some of them shake their plastic cups with annoyance because their ice is melting, and I shake my head in vain, hoping to dispel some of the ether inside my soul. The plane zooms effortlessly forward, a precision dart on course for its destination. But the cabin seems filled with fog as I reach for my laptop. Now, let's be clear, because a moment's reflection will cause me to know that actually to live life for nothing, to merely survive, is no blessing but a true curse. But I'm trying to be honest about doubt here. In a tired and even mildly depressed condition that long plane flight seems to create in me, I can feel battered by waves of uncertainty and disorientation. So, as I've tried to be really honest about doubt this evening, let's know that there's no magic conclusion here, no slick recipe to banish doubt for good, but just the realization that we Christians perhaps all suffer from it once in a while. Again, one day we'll see Jesus face to face, and life in the twilight zone of believing will be over forever. In the meantime, we live on the spiritual dark side of the moon, his face sometimes made distant and blurred by flesh, by life, by busyness, by fear. Resurrection will bring face-to-face revelation, and what a joy that will be. In the meantime, if you sometimes doubt, it doesn't make you a grade C Christian or a mighty pagan. As we've been reflecting with vulnerability and honesty about doubt, let's just think for a moment about Thomas, that disciple of Jesus, infamous for his capacity of doubt. He had one of those days when he missed a meeting when the resurrected Jesus showed up. Who knows what it was that caused him to miss one of the greatest episodes in human history? Was he working on his taxes, visiting a maiden aunt, lunching with an old friend? But he missed that meeting of all meetings when the resurrected Jesus appeared to his disciples, except Thomas. And now as they chattered endlessly about the awesome experience, you can imagine Thomas stoically having a posture not unlike that of a Victor Meldrew muttering, "I don't believe it." And he says that unless he can stick his fingers into the wounds of Jesus, then he's going to park in unbelief. And so we've tagged him Doubting Thomas. I'd like to suggest that he was actually a brave man who had previously shown willingness to die with Jesus if necessary. But because of his doubting, he's unlikely to be a winner in the I'm a disciple, get me out of here popularity contest. We all love Peter, that water-walking fisherman, impetuous, fragile, yet totally committed. But I think Thomas was quite a hero too, because he missed that meeting, and one of those days turned into one of those weeks. But then Jesus arrived again, and this time Thomas was there. He's still showing up, his doubts at that point unresolved, his insecurities lingering. He was there. He showed up. And apparently he ended his life bravely, martyred by spears at the command of an Indian king. His willingness to die for Jesus was no hollow promise. So as I conclude this evening, let's say hooray for so-called doubting Thomas. And if you're trusting God and still clinging to Christian community through one of those days, weeks, or even, God love you, one of those years, then a sincere, heartfelt hooray for you too. See you next time. Lucas on Life.